from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Thomas O'Brien is the Director of Research for the Center for International Trade and Transportation at California State University, Long Beach. He is also the Associate Director of Long Beach Programs for the Metrans Transportation Center, a partnership of CFULB and the University of Southern California. Jean-Paul Rodrigue received a PhD in Transport Geography from the Université de Montréal and has been a professor at Hofstra University since 1999. His research interests mainly cover the fields of transportation and economics as they relate to logistics and global freight distribution. Area interests involve North America, Latin America, and the Caribbean, and East and Southeast Asia. Specific topics over which he has published extensively cover maritime transport systems and logistics, global supply chains and production networks, gateways and transport corridors. He has authored 5 books, 25 book chapters, and more than 40 peer-reviewed papers, numerous reports, and delivered more than 130 conferences and seminar presentations, mostly at the international level. Christopher Lindsay is a PhD student in Northwestern University's Transportation Center. His research areas include freight logistics, land use, and transportation policy. Currently, his work involves the application of behavioral and optimization models to transportation spot market transactions. Prior to coming to Northwestern University, Christopher attended Morehouse College and the Georgia Institute of Technology, where he received degrees in applied physics and civil engineering. He also worked as a transportation engineer for the Georgia Department of Transportation. Mr. Lindsay is a past fellow of the EO Transportation Foundation Leadership Development Conference. Dr. Miguel Haye is a research associate at the Center for Infrastructure, Transportation, and the Environment at the Volvo Research and Educational Foundation's Center of Excellence for Sustainable Urban Freight Systems at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. He has strong theoretical foundations and practical experience in industrial and transportation engineering and management. His areas of interest are freight transportation, sustainable transportation systems, city logistics, supply chain management, emergency response management, and operations research. He has several scientific and technical publications and has made presentations at different national and international venues. He has been a part of a number of important research and consulting projects. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the presenters and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will not be answering the questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the Q&A session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we'll attempt to get written responses from the presenters to the unanswered questions. The PowerPoint presentations used today are available for download in the box in the lower right corner of your screen, and the presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript. I will notify all attendees once these materials are posted online. One final note, Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, please type your name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box of how to obtain your credits after the seminar. Today's webinar is not yet available on the AICP website, but I'll send out a notice once it is. For those of you who are not AICP members but would like to receive credits, please note that FHWA does not formally offer PEHs. However, it may be possible to receive credits for your participation if you are able to self-certify. To possibly receive PEHs, please download the agenda from the file download box and submit it to your respective licensing agency. Finally, I also encourage everyone to please download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit it to me after the seminar. We'll now go ahead and get started with our first presenter, Thomas O'Brien from the Center for International Trade and Transportation at California State University, Long Beach. So, Tom, you can go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Jennifer. I hope you can hear me okay. My job today is an easy one. It's just to provide a little bit of background and context for the three presentations that are about to follow. As Jennifer mentioned, I'm Tom O'Brien. I'm the Director of Research for the Center for International Trade and Transportation at California State University, Long Beach. And our center, CITT, has been the Long Beach home of the Metrans Transportation Center, which is a partnership of Cal State Long Beach and USC. The center was established in 1998. Our charge has been to work on transportation problems that plague large metropolitan areas. We have benefited from being a university transportation center as part of the FHWA UTC program with matching core financial support from Caltrans, the state DOT here in California. Our programs at MetTrans involve research, education, and outreach. We have a wide area of focus on all transportation-related issues, including transit, but we've taken a particular advantage of our gateway status here in Southern California to do a lot of work in the area of freight. Miguel had, in his bio, he mentioned that he's doing work as part of the Volvo Research and Education Foundations. We have a similar center of excellence here focused on urban freight. And we also are partners with UC Davis in the National Center for Sustainable Transport, again, focusing on freight. One of the projects that we started in 2006 was the Urban Freight Conference. Our feeling being that there needed to be a forum to share information and research on all aspects of goods movement within metropolitan areas. So that means going beyond sort of the efficiency of city logistics operations to encompass all of the range of issues that are involved in moving goods within and through metropolitan areas. We wanted it to, we now do it every 2 years. We did it for two consecutive years in the beginning, but we now offer it every 2 years. And the most recent conference that you're going to be hearing about today was just last week, October 8th through 10th. We shifted the name this year from National Urban Freight to International Urban Freight to reflect the range of topics being addressed, where the speakers were coming from, and the general themes that were being addressed. The conference had a representation from over 16 different countries. And as I mentioned, it's a forum for us to not only engage researchers, but also industry professionals, the practitioners of urban freight, the shippers, the operators, the third-party coordinators, as well as the regulatory agencies engaged in urban freight, and those who plan for the infrastructure on which the freight moves. I mentioned that we attempted to cover all aspects of urban freight. The papers and presentations, including the three that you're going to be hearing from today, reflect a wide range of urban freight issues. This year, not surprisingly, we had an increased emphasis on local last-mile pickup and delivery, which is driven in many ways by the rise in e-commerce and home shopping, environmental impacts and responses, which has always been a focus of the urban freight presentation, urban economics and what drives shippers to use particular shipping lanes, port gateway operations, which, given where we are in Southern California, where the conference was hosted, plays a critical role in the discussion surrounding urban freight, freight and urban modeling and planning, the use of intelligent transportation systems and their applications in urban freight, hubs and city interactions. I mentioned e-commerce, which is reflected in one of the tracks that we had on emerging trends in consumption, production, and spatial organization, security and vulnerability, and best practices. With best practices being widely defined and coming from all sorts of places around the world and involving operations, infrastructure, development, and planning. The keynote presentations came from UPS, Chuck Collins, the Vice President of Engineering, who talked about the changing nature of small package delivery and the impact of different types of urban forms on the ability of UPS to do what it does. And Jake Raker, Regional Logistics Director for Kroger, who talked about food distribution. We had special sessions hosted by the Transportation Research Board's Urban Freight Committee, who looked at research and practitioner interaction, which continued a dialogue that happened at TBRB's annual meeting in last January, and will hopefully set the stage for what they do this coming January. We have an annual state of the practice offered by industry professionals, which looks at what researchers need to know about what's happening in industry these days and what research would be useful to support that. We have spotlight presentations from the two Volvo Centers of Excellence in Urban Freight, which bring a global perspective to the debate. We had special sessions focusing on the unique role of metropolitan planning organizations and councils of government in planning for urban freight. We had a session that focused on different perspectives of the Panama Canal expansion and what it means for metropolitan regions, not only on the East Coast and West Coast of the U.S., but in other parts of the world. And we had site visits to an automated food distribution center at Kroger and the Alameda Corridor. I bring these up because it might be of interest to you to know that post-conference, the papers and presentations from the conference will be posted on the MetTrans website, which is MetTrans.org. So you're getting a flavor today of just the three presentations, but there'll be a lot more online. We will also have a conference summary that's going to be posted as well. And selected papers from the conference will form a special issue of a journal called Research in Transportation Business and Management. And with that, I will look forward to engaging any questions at the end about the conference or otherwise, and I will now turn it back over to Jennifer to get the heart of the program started.
Well, thank you, Tom. Our next presentation will be given by Dr. Jean-Paul Rodrigue from Hofstra University. So, Jean-Paul, I will bring up your presentation, and you can go ahead and get started.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll start off with this with a very, very wide picture of city logistics. You can call them global city logistics systems. It's the outcome of joint work with my colleague Laetitia Dablan from the University of Paris Est in France. And our goal here was to try to find some level of commonality in terms of city logistics across the world. It was a fairly complex endeavor in terms of data availability, so I'll explain a little bit later on regarding this issue. So for those of you who are interested, we just had a couple of interesting publications about this issue. One was just released last week by United Nations Habitat, annual report on global report on human settlement, and that for the first time, and that was probably quite interesting, they actually decided to consider freight as an element of urban sustainability. I sound a little bit sarcastic here, because again, that's the point. In the past, there is a very clear bias in terms of sustainability issues and urban areas. And I was actually commissioned to write that chapter. So I provide here a link in the PowerPoint presentation when you have in front of you, or let's say the PDF file. And also, if you want more information, there's also a section about city logistics in my online web book about the geography of transportation system. So the point is, and when you look at this book cover, people, again, there's a bias. You look at city logistics, and it's people walking, bus company running in the red, driving around, bankrupt BRTs running around, and cycling, bicycles. And again, where's the freight? And that's the point of this bias. And when you look at all the attempts that were made in the past to classify or to look at urban sustainability and consider some form of classification system by level of efficiency or level of environmental effectiveness, if you wish, there was, and what we found out, there's actually not a single variable or element was considering urban freight as part of sustainability. Again, there is a bias, and that bias takes many, many dimensions. You can look at this issue in terms of urban planning and the fact that urban planning, or let's say, did not consider very well city logistics in the past, for the reason that the most of the realm of engagement between the public sector and the city were done on public transportation systems. while freight remains a private business. So most planners, stakeholders in the public sector are not that well trained to consider city logistic issues. So now to move on and to move within that this rationale of trying to identify some form of pathology, it's a complex endeavor for two interesting reasons. The first one is the fact that, of course, cities across the world have different landscapes, different morphologies, different levels of density, different history, different land use policies, and so on and so forth. So first of all, so there's a very wide variety of urban contexts. And to this complexity, you must add the very wide variety of supply chains that are intersecting, that are overlapping this urban freight distribution issue. So again, that's part of the issue. We have city logistics is, first of all, city-specific. In addition, city logistics is supply chain-specific. So let's move on to try to guess what could be the major criteria we try to use here. So we use classic criteria linked, again, to in terms of urban classification, linked with density, spatial structure, government, income, and even function, because you notice around the world that there's some kind of emphasis between cities that are based upon production, such as cities in China, obviously, based upon consumption-based cities, which are more, let's say, service-oriented, and the cities in between, which are gateways, which act as major distribution clusters, if you wish, of urban freight. So to this, we had some form of city logistic issue linked with operations, modes, vehicles, and land, infrastructure, and policies. Okay. So here's the first question we ask ourselves, and that's a pretty tough one. Where is there a threshold, or let's say a population or a size threshold, where cities start to have city logistic type of problems? That is, you need some form of approach, some form of intervention. And we tried to get some data, but there was very limited, if any, data across the world. So we took the Texas Transportation Institute data set, about which has been compiling for quite a while, about urban congestion. And when you look at this from a very simplistic perspective, the rule of the thumb, and again, we have to be very careful, you have to take this with a very big, large grain of salt, is when you reach about 1 million, it seems to be a threshold. When a city reaches about 1 million people, where you start to have some form of city logistic issues. And again, we have very little data for other parts of the world, and we'll see when we start to get more information if this little 1 million population threshold holds true or not. I suspect it might be a valid one. Okay. So let's start with the density issue, which we try to classify. And immediately we reach, of course, some very easy similarity. That is, across the world, there are very specific regional characteristics in terms of the density of cities across the world. And this is pretty well known. That is, North American cities have much lower level of density than European cities and Asian cities, Latin American cities, and vice versa. That's fairly well known. But what we realize that this whole density issue was creating a conundrum, a paradox, if you wish, between what people in regular, let's call it passenger urban transportation, consider as sustainable, and from the city logistics standpoint, what would be more efficient. That is, if you look at all the urban sustainability literature, most of the literature advocates that the higher the density, the better, which of course makes sense. But from a city logistic perspective, the higher the density, once you reach a certain threshold, you start to have more costly city logistic systems. So there is some diseconomies in this sense. That is, higher density in terms of city logistic does not seem to be that preferable. And again, very high density cities that start to reach diseconomies, there are all sorts of problems which require a lot of intervention. So that's an interesting puzzling paradox, if you wish, between what is sustainable or what is practical in terms of urban freight distribution and what is sustainable or practical in terms of, let's say, passenger transportation within metropolitan area. And I suspect in the future, it's going to create a little bit some kind of debate, obviously, between what is the preferable density and so on and so forth. And And when you, and of course this density issue in that we're using here a very small sample, it is also further exaggerated by what's happening within the city itself. That is, many cities around the world, when you get clear, let's say closer to the central business district, the density increase quite substantially, and you start to have very constraining systems for urban freight distribution. When of course, as you move towards the, let's say peripheral area, that you start to have what we call to enter the realm of what we could be called, the suburban logistics, where there doesn't seem to be too much of an issue. So again, that's another issue you have to keep in mind when you start to classify the whole picture. In addition, there's a whole landscape of what is urban, from suburban areas towards high-density central areas. So there's a continuum, and each element of this involves different aspects, different strategies. So you have to be very careful when you start to classify systems, that these systems have their own form of regional continuum. And one very powerful trend, and as the next map will depict, is the emergence of mega regions or urban regions across the world. And then as part of this project, we started up to try to identify them, what were across major continents. And some of North America is pretty well known. You have, of course, the classic Boston-Washington corridor, Southern California are well-known mega regions. But you have also to consider the eastern coast of China and what's happening in Western Europe as also a major form of a city region. And this complexifies the issue because in addition to be concerned about urban freight distribution within a metropolitan area, you have to consider that this freight distribution system, this urban freight distribution system, is part of a wider region. That is, for instance, if you want to service the Boston-Washington corridor, proper locations could be in Pennsylvania, could be along somewhere around the corridor. So it creates some form of mismatch between metropolitan city logistics and, let's say, mega-regional city logistics or systems. Another issue we try to measure, to assess, is obviously the intensity of urban GDP will be linked, with, of course, with the level of consumption. So this map pretty much represents the GDP per capita for a metropolitan area around the world, and the division is very clear between the triad of Western Europe, East Asia, Japan, of course, and North America. This is where most of their consumption is taking place. So the point is behind this, you have to be very careful when you consider cities from a GDP perspective, or as opposed to considering cities from a population perspective. And the next task was try to identify, to classify within this system, what were the major gateways, because cities are also acting, of course, as interfaces between global freight distribution system and regional and, of course, metropolitan freight distribution system. So what we tried to assess here was how could we ponder or measure the level of freight intensity of metropolitan areas around the world by using proxies, in this case, which is the level of intermodal port traffic and the level of air transportation traffic, in that case, agglomerated by urban areas. And this is, in a sense, the outcome of this exercise, trying to assess the major gateway cities of the global system. And immediately you will notice a very high level of concentration across of these gateways. And Tom was quite right initially to tell that Los Angeles, as you can clearly see here, is a major gateway for North America. And if you look we were shocked when we were assembling this data about the level of freight intensity by city or gateway region, that the Pearl River Delta itself was accounting for about 11-12% of all the freight activity of this planet. And you put again the Yangtze River Delta, which is around Shanghai, the Strait of Malacca, which is around Singapore, the Rhine Shell Delta, which is mostly Antwerp, Rotterdam, and so on and so forth, Dubai. So immediately you notice a very high level of concentration of freight activity along the city regions or metropolitan regions, or again, mega regions, if you wish. And the next slide, again, we look at specific metropolitan area in terms of assessing their gateway intensity. And this of course, you see the usual suspects in terms of Shanghai, Singapore, Hong Kong, all the major export-oriented cities, and you see also interesting things such as Dubai, which are intermediary locations in terms of their global freight flows. And also, and that's also an interesting thing, we start to plot this level of freight intensity by metropolitan area with the GDP, and immediately two type of trends or two patterns emerge in terms between of the level of gateways, in terms of the cities which are focusing, which are gateways, but are major global cities, metropolitan areas, which have also a wide other levels of freight activity. While you have also the other trend, you have cities which are gateways and seems to be focusing very substantially on this gateway function. And quite interesting, you look at Los Angeles, and the metropolitan area is somewhat in between some kind of a pure gateway city with high level of freight intensity and a large commercial global city such as Tokyo, New York, Seoul, London, Paris, and so on and so forth. And then we try another exercise, and many of you have heard about the LPI, which is called the Logistic Performance Index, which is a measure, let's call it the Logistics Perception Index, if you wish, which is measured at the country level. And we try to see if we could cross-reference this between, let's say, the LPI observed within a country and, let's say, the individual cities. Of course, it's a very hazardous cross-referencing, but that's the best we could come up with because there is no city-specific or metropolitan area-specific measures of logistic performance yet. That's one of the goals we would like to achieve over the next few years, is try to see if we could assess one at the metropolitan level. But as a starting point, we try to cross-reference a country's LPI and then their metropolitan area. And actually, we reach very interesting results. That is, roughly something close to 75% of all the urban population of this planet, the urban population living in cities of more than 1 million people, were living in metropolitan area, which were in countries qualified as logistically deficient. And only 26% of the global urban population was living in countries which was labeled as logistically efficient with an LPI higher than 3.5. So here's our initial classification. I have about two slides left here in terms of this exercise. That's the first stage of this exercise, and it is the first major cut, categories of city logistics systems. And we get four categories in terms of, and they're not that, can I say that, complicated. They're pretty straightforward, actually. The first category is pretty obvious. You have major metropolitan areas in developed economies, which have high income, lots of retail activity, and they are involved in modern freight distribution systems. This is, of course, pretty obvious. The second category, which is a very different city logistics system, are all the metropolitan areas in emerging economies, which are very large urban agglomerations, but often are characterized by what we call dual freight distribution systems. That is, they are modern freight distribution systems, UPS, FedEx, and all these type of activities. In addition, there's a massive informal sector which takes care of a lot of distribution within metropolitan areas. Then a category which was clearly standing out, which is very interesting, are what we call the gateway cities. They are large metropolitan areas, they are consumption related, that's for sure, but in addition to have this form of city logistic problem of that last mile, they are also embedded in global freight distribution system and a regional freight distribution system because they have also internal city logistic problem, plus they act as intermediary in this system of circulation. And when you are an intermediate, you have also some kind of a problem because the freight in one way or the other will enter and exit your metropolitan area. And that freight is not bound to your city. So that was an important category to acknowledge. And last was the medium-sized cities within 1 and 2 million people. And in this case, most of the city logistic problems were very specific, maybe linked to an historical central area or another part of the city. And again, it was not that clear if a concerted approach was required regarding this metropolitan area. And that's the last slide. That is the attempt at classification with five major categories from the gateways in light and dark blue And you notice again, in this case, that LA, it acts as a gateway city. New York is, of course, a gateway city. And that's kind of a surprise. Cities such as London and Paris, which we initially thought would be more regular metropolitan area, were actually gateway cities because they were involved in larger systems of circulation. Again, that was a little bit of initial surprise. And then the other categorization is obviously between the light and dark green. Light green between the large metropolitan area, which are not necessarily gateway, they are major production or consumption centers. So most of the city logistic problems are metropolitan focus. But here's our other old problem. We noticed when we classified city logistic systems in developing economy, you notice that we put central China, interior China, India, Africa, and many Latin American cities in the same category. And of course, this is completely wrong. But at this point, we have not yet accumulated enough information to try to categorize what in developing economies, what city logistics involves across different regions. Of course, when we compare India and China, it's completely different, a little bit of a different ballgame. So the point is behind this classification, if you would like to establish a form of commonality in terms of approach, in terms of policy, to understand city logistics across the world, you have to classify these cities, these systems first, to see what do they have in common and what distinguish themselves. And I believe if we are achieving such a form of classification, we will be better able to understand what city logistics means in different urban or metropolitan areas across the world. And that will be it for me. And I have four more slides in the presentation, which I won't discuss, which presents a little bit more detail about this classification. So the audience is free to browse to them. I'm just going to show them a little bit here. They're right there. And again, we will go into more detail about what we mean by these classification criteria. And that's about it for me for today. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Jean-Paul. Our next presentation will be given by Christopher Lindsay from Northwestern University. Christopher, I will bring up your presentation, and you can go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer. So, title of my presentation today is Industrial Space Demand and Freight Transportation Activity, and it's one of the connections. So, to begin, an important supply chain decision is where to locate logistics facilities. It's been estimated that approximately half of a distributor's costs are related to freight transportation. And so within private industry, this has really led to a reconfiguration of supply chain where global companies are now seeking to decrease their transportation costs and to increase their supply chain flexibility. So because this is sort of the trend that's going on now, both sides of the marketplace, both the customer firms that demand logistics facilities and the provider firms that supply these facilities must now increasingly consider the geography of freight flows and also regional dynamics in management decisions. So the outline for my presentation today, I'm going to describe the problem that I'm looking at exactly, the questions and objectives of my research. I'm going to give some background to the problem. I'm going to describe my methodology and data. And lastly, my research findings and the implications of it. So, the developers of major logistics facilities are increasingly considering transportation hubs as prime investment markets. And this is really based on the notion that freight activity is a good indicator of demand for industrial space. And so, this research is really exploring the assertion that industrial space demand, demographic, and freight flow measures are interconnected. And so to just give you a little bit of clarification on this problem, I know many of you all are probably public sector planners and work on transportation policy. Basically, the angle that I'm coming from is from that of a private developer who is looking to build warehouses, is looking to build distribution centers in different metropolitan regions and to attract customers to that development. And so the insights and the value of this that I think goes to the public sometimes these developments sort of lead the actual transportation infrastructure. So that's the real value that I think is to much of the audience today. So the two primary research questions is, can industrial space demand be predicted as a function of demographic, macroeconomic, and freight flow variables? And also, do regions with greater freight flows exhibit higher levels of industrial land consumption? And so the objectives today are to identify those economic drivers of demand and also to examine that relationship between the demand for industrial space and freight flow measures. So a little of the academic or theoretical background behind this. So the decision to consume space in one place or another really goes back to regional science and location theory. Transportation accessibility is a central tenet of many of the early location theories, and a lot of the empirical studies have confirmed the importance of accessibility to location decisions. In other words, what is going to make a firm decide to consume space in one location versus another? As you move from the location theory literature into the more industrial space demand literature, you get into one theory called the path of goods movement. And basically, it's a theory that states that warehouse space demand is highly correlated with the path that goods flow from sources, which are mainly manufacturers, to destinations. Consumption bases, which are your population centers. And so where this research hopes to make a contribution to Interjet is to explore the demand for industrial space and its connection to those variables and really provide a model that gives some insight into that process and also provides a basis for prediction. So the methodology that we're using is basically a regression model for longitudinal data. Within our data set, we have 20 different metropolitan markets, and we observe the consumption of industrial land in each of these markets over time, 11 years to be exact. So we have a regression model to treat this type of data, and we explore our different model specifications and different variables and try to see basically which is statistically significant and what's not. Okay, so this is basically a map of the 20 areas that are used in this study. They're pretty much evenly spread between the east and west coast. There is a big gap sort of in the middle of the country, but that part of the country also doesn't have much in the way of population. So we mostly concentrated on the east coast, the southeast, and the west coast of the United States. Okay, so some summary statistics of the different variables that we're looking at. So our measure of demand is net absorption. So this is basically the net change in occupied space within a market. So this this is our dependent variable, and it can be both positive and negative. So this is positive if from year to year a market constantly consumes more space than it's vacated. You get negative measures when firms are actually leaving or decreasing their footprint, and you're actually losing, not losing space, but you're losing the consumption of that space in that area. So this is our measure, the true measure of demand, because it can be both positive and it can be negative. Some of our economic variables include measures of U.S. GDP, national unemployment, and those are both at the national levels. At more local and state levels, we have per capita income, state employment, population growth. And for our freight flow measures, we look at a few different measures. We look at the tons and the ton miles of freight originating and destined for a particular metropolitan market. So these are our variables, and let's look at a few of our results. So in this figure, we have four different models, and the things that immediately pop out at us are that our population growth, our measure of GDP growth, and our employment measures all have positive impacts on the amount of industrial space that is consumed in another one that at first is surprising, but I think that it makes sense, is per capita income. Our results are showing that as per capita income increases, actually less space, industrial space, is consumed in that market. And really what I think that suggests is that labor is getting more expensive in that market. So demand actually decreases with that measure. Now, what's really interesting in the main focus of our study are the freight flow measures, because, as I said before, really this whole research endeavor was started to see if there's some positive correlation, as past theory suggested, between freight flows in metropolitan markets and the actual amount of industrial space consumed in that market. And so across the board, we're seeing that we do get very positive and statistically significant correlations between our freight flow measures, which are origin times, destination times, origin time miles, and destination time miles, and the demand for industrial space. So it really does confirm past theories and also the investment strategy that targeting markets that have heavy freight flows is good for business. And likely it's good for business because it's suggesting that these are hub markets and that they can support these heavy industrial sectors that perhaps other areas cannot. And so when we apply our research results to a couple of markets just to get some visual confirmation of what we're seeing in the regression model, we see that the model does a pretty decent job. So on the left-hand side of the screen is Atlanta, Georgia. On the right-hand side is Los Angeles, California. And we see that our model does a pretty good job of reproducing the actual demand in those markets. Where it does not do such a good job is in the year 2001. And, of course, in that year in the U.S., there was a terrorist attack and also a recession. So that we missed that in our model is not too surprising considering the external factors. But overall, we think that we did a good job in capturing that. And so at this point, some preliminary conclusions are that freight flows are an indicator of demand. There's a strong positive association. And also that macroeconomic and demographic drivers of demand can be used to predict it. Now, some further questions from the research. So, of course, in the previous slide, you observed that precipitous drop in demand in the year 2001. And so that really sparked another question on our end, was that does this represent a structural change in the industrial space market? And the answer is yes, it does. We did a chow test, which basically tests for breaks in regression data, and we found that there is a structural change, and that it's a very significant one. And also we decided to look at, is there a difference between inland and port markets, and sort of how does that difference manifest itself? And yes, there was a difference in inland versus port markets. And in every case, the effect of landside freight flows is larger. And so I'm going to show you all a few slides on these nets and explain this a little bit more. And so in post-2001 demand, the biggest difference was in population growth. In post-2001 Virginia, it was nearly the parameter estimate was nearly 55% higher. The smallest change was in national unemployment. So in other words, that relationship did not seem to change too much. And we think that these results imply that after a recession, demand depended a little more heavily on local conditions versus those national conditions. Now, for port versus inland markets, one thing that you notice when we split the data between those markets that are inland and those markets that are port is that the inland markets is a bit higher and really more statistically significant demand is for our freight flow parameter estimates, that is, for our freight flow measures. And so this is really suggesting that the variables that we are using really capture those inland markets better than the port markets. And really, as a follow-up, if we reread some of this analysis, I would probably look at some more variables for those port markets, because clearly those freight flow measures correlate more much stronger with those inland markets. So in other words, we think that there's some other things going on in those port markets that were not exactly captured as well as we would have liked. So the implications of the research are that robust transportation infrastructures that can handle large freight flows are a critical aspect of the demand for industrial space in metropolitan markets. That markets that are hubs of logistics activity represent superior investment opportunities for the private sector, and from all indications, the private sector will pursue investment in those markets as opposed to others. A shock occurred in the year 2001 that resulted in a structural change to the nature of demand, and also that freight flows, or at least as we've measured them, are better predictive of demand in inland versus port markets. Some final thoughts on this. Though the correlation between freight flows and space demand is clearly established, we have not established causality. So with this research, you can't say that freight flows causes investors to consume space in one market versus another, but the association is clear. Also unclear is whether or not this structural change is temporary or permanent that we observe in the pre- and versus post-2001 regimes. And also that the predictive ability of the models is hindered by the availability and the timeliness of the freight flow data. So basically for this study, we use commodity flow survey data, which is the only available source in the U.S., but we think that the study really could have been improved with a better data source. And so I have it here for a few questions, and I see a couple of questions that popped up on the screen that if I have time, I can address a couple of those now and perhaps say some for later. But we did explore using different models for the tons or the amount of freight versus the value of freight. And all our models using the amount of freight performed better than actually looking at the value of freight. And another question about freight flows being a better predictor for inland versus ports. Basically, we think that with the port markets, that there's something else going on that our model is not quite capturing, that there's something else about port markets. And so freight flows, as we've measured them, really seems to capture inland markets better than ports. Exactly why, I'm not certain at this point, but my intuition is that the market dynamics for port cities is slightly different than inland cities. That's my presentation for today. I'll be happy to answer some more questions at the end. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Christopher. Our final presentation will be given by Dr. Miguel Haye from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. So, Miguel, I will bring up your presentation, and you can go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Miguel Jaller. I'm a research associate for the Center of Infrastructure, Transportation and Environment, and the Center of Excellence for Sustainable Urban Freight Systems at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Today, I will try to give you a talk about large urban freight traffic generators and what we have found in terms of opportunities for city logistics initiatives. Well, first, just to set the tone, I will want to acknowledge my co-authors, Professor Carwan and Professor Holse Holdenberg. And this research is partially supported by NCPRP 25, NCPRP 38, USDOT, and the Volvo Research and Educational Foundation. The outline of the presentation is divided in three parts. First, I will talk about what we mean by urban freight large traffic generators. Second, what are the opportunities for city logistics? And third, how can we identify them? When you hear the word large traffic generator, the first thing that comes to your mind will be maybe ports, airports, intermodal terminals, produce markets. And they do generate a lot of traffic and mostly a lot of freight. But as you can see in the picture, most of that freight is moved through big trucks, containerized cargo, all cargo. That is mostly on the periphery going to be talking about much about these traffic generators. What I'm still interested in is what's going on inside the urban area. For instance, in New York City, you have the Grand Central Terminal, where there are more than 180 establishments that pay in a single day altogether to one single point, generate between 150 and 200 truck trips just in one day to that location. And you can see that in every other large conglomerate of buildings or establishments. For instance, also in the lower right side of the graph, you can see the deliveries made to a Midtown hotel in Midtown Manhattan. You can see maybe Monday they receive more than 15 trucks, and that kind of happens in every single day. So this is what we mean by urban freight large truck generators. It doesn't need to be those old facilities, those ports, airports, but these large establishments, large buildings, large conglomerates of buildings, that together they produce a large bulk of the traffic. Just imagine in your building, you mostly work in an office building or a group of buildings, and I don't know if you have made the exercise of just looking what happens every day, how many trucks are attracted by your building, how many deliveries that your office receives, how many deliveries that your department receives. Do you know if they are doing some kind of consolidation? Do you know who is ordering office supplies, print toner? Are you ordering from the same supplier? Are you ordering from different? Are you consolidating or only one shipment? So those are the things that we may not think about, but they create a lot of traffic. They may be smaller packages, but they'll need one truck to make it to your location. So the difference between the two types of traffic generators can be understood with look at this graph. Here, this graph shows the probability of using different types of trucks from small to large for different distances of shipments. For instance, on the right side of the graph, you can see larger distances that will usually involve larger shipment sizes, and they would mostly use large trucks. Whereas on the left side of the graph, where you see mostly your urban areas, the probability of using those large trucks is not the same. Why? Because we are not doing that much consolidation, because there are constraints, because there are regulations. So in essence, in urban areas, we are mostly looking at a lot of traffic coming from smaller trucks for different reasons. So to conclude this section, while we talk about large urban freight traffic generators, is those establishments, those big buildings that together generate a lot of traffic. Just to compare them, you can see in the right, in the top table, all the deliveries that are made in Manhattan in one single day. They account for roughly about 300,000 truck trips between the ones that are received and the ones that are produced. And then when you can see the number of truck trips produced at the Port of New York and New Jersey, there's only 9,000 truck trips in a single day. They only account for 2.6% of the Manhattan traffic. So who's producing the rest of the traffic? Well, the rest of the establishment, the economic activity, the residential orders, all those economic, those result from the economic behavior or economic health of the city. So, large urban freight traffic generators, we can divide it into, or we divide it into for this type of research, large buildings and landmarks around the area, but there are also issues such as they will require a lot of coordination efforts. And as you may know, in large urban areas, large dense areas, space is limited, and the price or the cost to allocate this space for not a commercial value-adding activity is kind of constrained. But we have been working with some of the developers and trying to develop some alternatives to improve, at least in new developments, the creation of these stations and receiving stations. The next one we look at was the pickup and drop-off points and unattended delivery. Pickup and drop-off points are those, for example, drop-off lockers, such as the ones that the USPS is using now, or you can also see Amazon is using some of type of these lockers in different bodegas and supermarkets. What is the advantage of all of these? That they can be placed in one of those large buildings or the entrances or the lobbies, and they can address or mitigate some of the traffic. In addition, unattended deliveries, we have seen that we want to improve some of the activities. We need to provide a balance between what the customer needs and the customer has with what the supplier or the carrier has. So we can divide that and allocate a space for the carrier to drop off the goods so that the receiver doesn't incur into any extra cost that will improve operations. We can do that using different types of technologies. For example, double door systems. If a carrier, if a receiver has a trusted vendor, they can give the key to the carrier. The carrier can go in at different times. Nobody has to be there. Leave the stuff between the two doors and they'll leave. Also, you can do some more technologies like virtual cages with alarm system. Next, parking and loading and unloading activities. Well, when you have this spatial aggregation of traffic, you are going to have parking problems. You will need to have loading facilities available for these trucks to come in and use the freight elevators and so on. So you can address that by maybe introducing parking prices. It has been done in several cities in the country. You can also implement reserve parking. They will need coordination between the receivers and carriers. You can also assignate loads to nearby delivery areas wherever space is available. And also you need to improve, or we need to improve, on a still loading base. Some of these are low capital investment. They will mostly reduce congestion. We will need to address toll parking. In Manhattan, for instance, a study we conducted, we identified 10 zip codes where the demand for parking space is much larger than the actual offer availability in terms of physical space. Some of the other issues we need to address in large and urban and dense areas is how to manage the conflict between all these freight activities with other users such as pedestrians and cyclists. One of the issues with the parking and loading and unloading initiatives is that we need to enforce them, and that will require extra efforts. But I guess we also can try to enforce or induce a change in behavior and limited space. So all of this will affect the way the operations are done in the city and try to improve them. So we have seen that we can do this at all of these type of facilities. Why? Because they have the space, they are concentrated in specific locations. So how can we identify them? Well, we developed a few practical measures to do so. First, in Manhattan at least, there are a lot of buildings and landmarks that have their own zip code. They have their own zip code because the USPS has already identified them as producing a lot of mail and maybe deliveries. What is good about these ways to identify them is that you can geolocate them easily. However, And since there are normally no detailed data sets, you will only be able to do this at the aggregate level, at the zip code, or maybe at the partial level. So we're doing this. I'm going to show you some of the results from Manhattan and New York. Well, the first one, as I mentioned, is the large landmark buildings. We identified about 90 of these landmark buildings, or at least unique zip codes in Manhattan. But from those, 56 that are shown in the table account for about 13,000 of the truck trips in a single day. So that's a lot of traffic. If you remember what the board was producing, 9,000, and then you have 56 buildings that are producing 13, you can see the magnitude of the amount of traffic that they generate. In the case, for instance, the Empire State Building, inside the building there are 594 establishments. And just to say maybe 2 to 3 truck trips per day for each of them, that will account for the 1,500, 1,900 truck trips arriving to that single location. So you can see that for all those large buildings. The next one, in terms of size, in terms of employment, we divided, we used between 250 and 499, 599, and 1,000 plus employees. And as you can see on the graph, all those establishments, depending on the measure, are located both in Midtown Manhattan and Downtown Manhattan. And when you contrast this with the pedestrian generation in the city, you can see that most of the traffic is at these locations. The next one, in terms of area, we selected, as I said, the 1% of the parcels in the city. And again, they are also located in Midtown Manhattan and Downtown Manhattan. So we have two of these black spots of traffic in the city that, although being together creates more problems, it's also easier to address them. So to conclude this table shows some of the summary in terms of regeneration for all these three measures. When you compare landmarks, those 56 buildings, they correspond to about 6,000 establishments in Manhattan, and they account for about 4% of all the truck traffic in the city. So just by focusing on those 56 buildings or locations, you can address more than if you go out and just try to address those 6,000 establishments on their own. You can only go to those locations and deal with the landlord regulations, with the union regulations, with the freight elevators. Since they're located, most of the buildings are located in one specific location, it would be easier just to construct retrofit one section of those buildings for a receiving station, and the cost can be shared among all the landlords. That will be easier. So, to conclude, what are the advantages? Well, all of these buildings and locations are easy to identify. We already know that they concentrate a large number of establishments in a reduced set of locations. They generate a significant share of the daily traffic, and their close spatial location allows for other alternatives, such as last-mile green distribution strategies using different type of alternative vehicles and modes. We can also do size and economy of scale cargo consolidation. We have been working on that with New York City DOT for the last year. In terms of disadvantages, well, space first. If we want to conglomerate, consolidate cargo at different times of the day, we will need to have space to store it in for some time. That involves also security management and liability issues. It's going to take care of these goods. And limited loading facilities lead to increased scheduling complexity. If you want to organize and consolidate and schedule more deliveries and more activities throughout the day and to optimize all of these activities, you will need to have a large deal of issues in terms of consolidation and scheduling. But in essence, what we wanted to do with this work is to show that we don't need to try to solve all
the question and answer session with the questions posted online. I know that we've had a few of the questions answered, typed in already, but I'm going to go ahead and still ask those just to try to get a little more detailed responses. And everybody feel free to continue typing in questions, and we will get through as many as we can. So let me see here. So the first question, I believe it was for Jean-Paul, and that question was, can you please explain what LPI stands for, or what LPI consists of?
Okay, I already provided a link to a detail a web page which provides an explanation in detail, so those of you are interested. But just to summarize, the LPI is a measure developed by the World Bank, and it's been done on a fairly regular basis and by interviewing managers across the world. And it's a composite measure that includes several variables, including customs, including paperwork, how efficient distribution is within a